The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to Luke.
Glory to you, Lord Christ.
Some Sadducees, those who say there is no resurrection, came to Jesus and asked him a question. Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, leaving a wife but no children, the man shall marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first married and died childless. Then the second and the third married her. And so in the same way, all seven died childless. Finally, the woman also died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? For the seven had married her. Jesus said to them, those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of a place in that age and in the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Indeed, they cannot die anymore, because they are like angels and are children of God, being children of the resurrection. And the fact that the dead are raised, Moses himself showed in the story about the bush, where he speaks of the Lord as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now he is not God of the dead, but of the living. For to him, all of them are alive. The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, Lord Christ.
Amen. The really real. When I was a boy, I belonged to the Boy Scouts. Now, before I go where that leads, you need to know that I'm originally from a small town in Ohio, right smack on the Pennsylvania border, just a tiny bit north of where the West Virginia Panhandle sticks up. The town line and state line are about 50 yards apart. The town is also on another border, a geophysical dividing line, dividing between two types of topography. On the north side of town, you go out that end, and you have gently rolling countryside called moraine country, produced by glaciers in the last ice age, which stuck right about where the town is. And on the south side of the town, you have steeply, hilly, dramatically beautiful landscape, the foothills of the Appalachians. And yes, that's how we said it back there. Likewise, the town seems to be on a third border. It's a fuzzy border, but with poetic license, we'll call it that, namely a linguistic dividing line. Some people in town have a certain accent and some do not. Let me give you an example of how some of my childhood friends talked, and of which I had a smidge, but not much. It went like this. This Friday, we're gonna have a spatial fish dinner, and after we've washed the dishes, I'm gonna go out and trim the bushes in the front yard. And then maybe I'll go out to a movie down at the big show. I have taken a long time to beat that out of my head. But after the farther north you go, that accent gradually disappears until you arrive in Cleveland. Merriam-Webster, the corporate heir to the true Noah Webster Works, decided some years ago that Cleveland's accent is the purest form of standard American English. Well, what's standard? Standard means simply it has no identifiable regional giveaway. It's the way I speak. many years later, my cousin and his wife told me that they had read that technically our town was considered to be in Appalachia on the fringes. So in what follows, I'm not saying that Appalachian people or hillbilly people are stupid. They emphatically are not. But it is true that some people in and around the town and places like it had unsophisticated worldviews, to wit. In the Boy Scout troop I belonged to, we had a young man whose father was convinced that all rivers and streams flow from north to south. They could bend a bit one way or the other, but the direction had to be generally south. The proof? Just look at any map. South is down towards the bottom of the page. Rivers have to flow downhill, so the logical conclusion is that they have to flow south. I guess he never bothered to notice that the Nile flows up. This is true. It's a true story. I kid you not. And by the way, his son agreed that his dad was mistaken. The Sadducees, in their encounter with Jesus in today's gospel, seems just as simple-minded as my friend's father. Their view of the afterlife was that it would be a mere extension of this life. It was this life, but long, and with some of the inconveniences cleaned up. So they get into problems if they started to apply logic to this simplistic view in cases like that of the woman with seven husbands. That's why they didn't believe in the resurrection or the afterlife. To them, it was a silly belief that made no sense and got you into logical conundrums, which of course is what it would do if you start out from their simple-minded premises. Jesus' view was different, and the difference comes out in one crucial line in our reading. When he mentions Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, he says, to God, all of them are alive. Jesus was saying that our reality is determined and delineated by what God sees. Reality is God's reality. That is the really real. After death, we are still in God's reality. That is what is real. Not some poorly or fuzzily conceived extension of this cleaned up and multiplied to infinity. That's not what it is. But the important point here is not about the afterlife, but rather that this is how Jesus saw everything and everyone. He saw them as God sees. He saw the really real. When Jesus looked at a beggar, he saw an honored guest at the banquet of God. When Jesus looked at a cripple, he saw someone striding energetically into the messianic banquet. When Jesus looked at a Gentile or anyone of a different race or ethnic group, he saw a fellow child of God. When Jesus looked at a member of one of the most downtrodden, marginalized groups of his time, women, he saw an apostle. It was to a woman that he gave the honor of being the first witness to the resurrection. And that is why to this day, the Eastern Orthodox call Mary Magdalene the apostle to the apostles. When he looked at members of another marginalized group, children, who in the society of that time literally didn't count until they reached a certain age when you could be reasonably sure that they were now adults and were going to survive, when he looked at them, he didn't see annoying little creatures whom the disciples tried to keep from bothering Jesus, which brought on the famous, suffer the little children to come unto me and forbid them not. No, when Jesus saw these, he saw bright blooming flowers, Garden of God. All of that was the real difference between the Sadducees and Jesus. The really real. That is also what marks the difference between Job and his so-called friends. This is not a time to go into the detailed analysis of that remarkable book or its subject, the problem of evil. That's for another sermon. Or rather, another book. Suffice it to say that one crucial difference between Job and his friends is that the friend's point of view is, again, simplistic. And What I'm going to describe is an actual school or current of thought in ancient Hebraic thought. You can see it many times in the Psalms. In this view, if you follow the right moral path and are in good standing with God, obeying all the rules, getting all the brownie points, nothing truly evil can happen to you. And if something evil does happen to you, then you must be in some way bad. And the converse or inverse, I get them mixed up, is if something bad happens to you, it must be because you are or have done something bad. The only thing wrong with that view is that it's wrong. History knows, and we all know, of figures who were very good and to whom bad things happened. Job didn't claim to know a lot or to understand what was happening to him, but he knew one thing. In chapter 9, outside of the part we read, he says, "I know I am not what I am thought to be." Job did not see himself according to the overly simplistic view of his friends. He may not have gotten all the way there, but he was moving towards understanding that his reality was not defined by superficial characteristics or by how his community sees him, but by his reality in God. Over a century and a quarter ago, a young girl in Massachusetts was sent to the Tewksbury Institute, which was the state poorhouse. The institute also eventually began to accept mental cases, and before long, its use was divided between being a mental illness ward, a hospital, and a poorhouse, a residence. It meant that children in the poorhouse were thus housed with people who had serious mental and physical illness. A young girl known as Little Annie was sent there. One story says that at one point she was classed as hopelessly insane and was eventually housed in the lower level of the institution, a place known as the dungeon, with small cells with bars. We don't know if the details are true, but what the record seems to show as incontestable is that Little Annie could be violent and intractable. Sometimes she would attack those trying to help or examine her, and sometimes she would simply ignore them. The story goes that one elderly nurse there decided that no one is hopeless, that in God there was hope for everyone. According to the story, she began sitting outside the girl's room or cell, talking with her. She didn't get much response, but one night she left a plate of fresh baked brownies within Annie's reach and told Annie they were for her. The girl gave no indication that she even heard what the nurse said. But the next day, the brownies were gone. Eventually, the story goes, Annie made more and more progress and was soon pronounced healthy and sane. Whatever the truth of all the details may or may not be in that story, it is true that early on, Little Annie was extremely difficult, intractable, erratic, and unteachable. She had been raised in extremely impoverished conditions and had arrived at the institute an orphan, and it was eventually discovered, for they didn't recognize this at first, she was also nearly blind because of a childhood disease she had had. Again, whatever the details, it is true that eventually someone saw her as worthwhile and brought her around to being salvageable. Eventually, she rose above the sadness of her early life. For you see, her name was Anne Sullivan, and her most famous accomplishment was the education and training of a young deaf and blind girl named Ellen Keller. So let us allow that story to stand as an example of the difference between what we think our reality is and how God sees us, and how that is our reality, and was able to see as God sees. To God, all of them are alive, said Jesus to the Sadducees. Jesus was saying that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and indeed all the people who have lived, or are living, or will live, are not what people ordinarily and too easily see. They were and are what God sees. What God sees to be is the really real, what we really are. What God sees in those whom we encounter in any context is what they really are. What God sees in distant lands, people in distant lands to be, fighting, or struggling, or suffering, or hoping, or fleeing some hoped-for analysis, some land of promise. What God sees them to be is what they really are. And that is how we are to see them. And that is how we are to see ourselves. Now, as we live and act on this planet, and it is our hope, after we leave it. For to God, all of them